The following message was given at Grace Community Church in Minden, Nevada.
So take our Bibles, please, and turn to Genesis chapter 31. It's a long chapter. We're going to break the reading up into two sections, and then I'll read the intervening sections as we go through the exposition. Genesis chapter 31, starting at verse 1. Now Jacob heard the words of Laban's sons, saying, "Jacob has taken away all that was our father's, and from what belonged to our father he has made all this wealth." Jacob saw the attitude of Laban, and behold, it was not friendly toward him as formerly. Then the Lord said to Jacob, "Return to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I will be with you." So Jacob sent and called Rachel and Leah to his flock in the field and said to them, "I see your father's attitude that is not friendly toward me as formerly, but the God of my father has been with me. You know that I have served your father with all my strength. Yet your father has cheated me and changed my wages 10 times. However, God did not allow him to hurt me. If he spoke thus, 'The speckled shall be your wages,' then all the flock brought forth speckled. And if he spoke thus, 'The striped shall be your wages,' then all the flock brought forth striped. Thus God has taken away your father's livestock and given them to me. And it came about at the time when the flock were mating that I lifted up my eyes and saw in a dream, and behold, the male goats which were mating were striped, speckled, and mottled. Then the angel of God said to me in the dream, 'Jacob,' and I said, 'Here I am.' He said, 'Lift up your eyes, lift up now your eyes and see all the male goats which are mating are striped, speckled, and mottled, for I have seen all that Laban has been doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar, where you made a vow to me. Now arise, leave this land and return to the land of your birth.' Rachel and Leah said to him, 'Do we still have any portion or inheritance in our father's house? Are we not reckoned by him as foreigners? For he has sold us and has entirely consumed our purchase price. Surely all the wealth which God has taken away from our father belongs to us and our children. Now then do whatever God has said to you.'" And then dropping down to verse 43, Laban overtakes Jacob and his clan, as we'll see. And then Laban replied to Jacob, "The daughters are my daughters, and the children are my children. The flocks are my flocks, and all that you see is mine. But what can I do this day to these my daughters or to their children whom they have borne? So now come, let us make a covenant, you and I, and let it be a witness between you and me." Then Jacob took a stone and set it up as a pillar. Jacob said to his kinsmen, "Gather stones." So they took stones and made a heap, and they ate there by the heap. Now Laban called it Jagar Sahudutha, but Jacob called it Galeed. Laban said, "This heap is a witness between you and me this day." Therefore, it was named Galeed and Mizpah. For he said, "May the Lord watch between you and me when we are absent from one another. If you mistreat my daughters, or if you take wives besides my daughters, although no man is with us, see, God is witness between you and me." Laban said to Jacob, "Behold this heap, and behold the pillar which I've set between you and me. This heap is a witness, and the pillar is a witness that I will not pass by this heap to you for harm, and you will not pass by this heap and this pillar to me for harm. The God of Abraham and the God of Nahor, the God of their father, judge between us." So Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac. Then Jacob offered a sacrifice on the mountain and called his kinsmen to the meal, and they ate the meal and spent the night on the mountain. Early in the morning, Laban arose and kissed his sons and daughters and blessed them. Then Laban departed and returned to his place. This is the reading of God's holy word. So here we have Jacob, and this is how we need to think about Jacob. Jacob is in exile. And he was forced out of the promised land by the death threats of Esau. And he ends up not going to the land of freedom, but to the house of bondage in Paddan Aram. I made a comment maybe a couple of weeks ago that Laban was very much like Pharaoh. And certainly for Jacob, Laban's house was the house of slavery. But now, Jacob, the deceiver, outwits Laban, the deceiver of the deceiver. And he's about ready to make good his escape. And notice the parallel. He's plundered Laban. And this is a long chapter, but and it really is sort of amazing how much attention God gives to the details of Jacob's life, and especially in this event. But in this long chapter, what we have is a crucial development in Jacob's life. Jacob comes out of this chapter as a man of deeper faith. And he comes out of this chapter as in a role that we've not seen up to this point, and that is leader of his family. The dramatic events of this chapter really can be called Jacob's exodus. This will be the last time that we see Laban. Jacob's exodus unfolds in four scenes. The first, 1 through 16, we can just simply call it's time to go, or getting out of Dodge, or getting out of Paddan Aram. 17 to 21, which we did not read, we could call stolen idols and a stolen heart. 22 to 42, the hot pursuit, which leads to the family feud. And then 43 to 55 is Jacob's triumph with what is called the Mizpah covenant. And so we start off with it's time to go, and the way that this scene begins to unfold is that Laban's sons begin talking, and Jacob hears the words of Laban's sons, and their words, of course, are bitter and jealous words, but they're really words that are not based in reality. They are words that, in a sense, have created their own narrative for themselves and for their father. In all likelihood, the words that Laban's sons are spouting and the complaints that they are leveling are simply based on the things that Laban himself has said. Jacob not only hears these words of criticism, complaint, these words of bitterness and jealousy, but Jacob also sees, quite literally, the rendering goes, that Laban's face was not with him. It's an idiom. The idea is, as the translation depicts, that Laban's attitude had changed towards Jacob. Just like the Philistines' attitude had changed with Isaac because of his prosperity, so now Laban and Laban's son's attitude change towards Jacob. And it's in the midst of this, Jacob's son, or Laban's sons and Laban himself, that then there is direct instruction from the Lord. In verse 3, God tells Jacob to return to the land of your fathers. Jacob is actually commanded directly by God to go back to the land of his fathers, which in a real sense ends up foreshadowing the Exodus itself. In the midst of that command, go back to the land of your fathers, you have God saying something to Jacob that is absolutely crucial, and it is this, and I will be with you. Remember, Jacob had left the promised land for his own safety. Now God is telling him to go back to the promised land for his own safety. And there is incredible risk that is going to be involved. And yet God tells him, I will be with you. He is echoing the very promise that he had given Jacob at Bethel. That Emmanuel principle that God is with us is now confirmed, and Jacob understands clearly that God's promised presence with him means his protection. Jacob then needs to explain this to his wives. If you've been tracking with the story, this may not be as easy as it first appears. And so Jacob takes the leadership of his home, and he ends up doing something that we've not seen Jacob do up to this point, and that is Jacob not only takes leadership, but Jacob testifies to God's faithfulness to him. This is something that's been strangely absent in Jacob's life, but now, at that moment of truth, when he is about to explain to his wives that it is time for them to go, he actually tells them that God has been faithful to him. And in the course of his speech, he makes numerous contrasts between Laban and God. So, for instance, Laban has been against him, but God is for him. Jacob affirms his hard work for Laban, and just remember, verse 6, he affirms that he'd been working hard. This is probably 20 years worth of honest labor in Jacob's life. Laban had cheated him, but God did not allow Laban to hurt him. Laban had changed his wages, and God had changed Laban's flocks. And so although Laban's intentions towards Jacob were evil, God actually was there at every step of the way, making sure that no evil befell Jacob. And when Jacob says, by the way, he's changed my wages these 10 times, he probably doesn't mean that he's literally changed the wages 10 times, but it probably has the idea of like this: enough is enough. For 20 years, he has gone back and forth, and he said, okay, the spotted ones. No, okay, the speckled ones. Okay, now the mottled ones. And he goes and he continues to change, and Jacob realizes that not only is he dealing with a charlatan who actually has out-charlatined the charlatan, but he can't take it anymore. Jacob then recounts a previous dream about how God had told him that he would end up prospering. Now, did you notice when we read the passage, there's something that's strangely missing as he recounts the dream, and that is God never told him to practice the folk magic of peeling the rods and sticking them in the troughs. That was Jacob's own superstition. That was Jacob covering his own bases. But it is interesting that as Jacob recounts this dream to Rachel and Leah, he says that God himself has taken note of Laban's mistreatment of me. What's interesting is that as Jacob uses this expression, this mistreatment, this phrase expresses the idea God takes note of the mistreatment, that God is being compassionate and is about to intervene or about to act. By the way, this very same language will be used again in Exodus chapter 2 when God takes note of the Israelites' mistreatment in the land of Egypt. God then echoes again his words from Bethel in this dream. And as we get to the end of Jacob trying to explain why they need to go, we end up having this unbelievable happy moment of family unity. Rachel and Leah are in full agreement with each other. The two sisters who were engaged in a Cold War arms race, who could make the most babies, using some pretty shady methods. Now they come to a place where they are in agreement, and they are agreement in their grievance towards their father. Isn't it amazing how grievances and complaints can pull people together? They ask a series of questions. But the questions that they ask in verses 14 to 16 are in all likelihood rhetorical questions. When they ask, do we still have any portion or inheritance in our father's house? It's not a legitimate question in a sense. They're recognizing that they simply don't. And are we not recognized by him as foreigners? The answer is yes. And so the idea is, as Jacob explains why they need to leave, why it is time for them to leave their father's house, they come to the conclusion, we need to leave. We have no inheritance here. We're treated not as beloved daughters, but as foreigners. He actually sold us deceitfully. And in fact, what God has done in taking away our father's flocks and giving them to you, Jacob, is actually just. Because God has done this thing, and now what belonged to our father now belongs to us and our children. And there's a sense in which they are saying, if it were not for God, none of us would have a future. If we stay here, we'll never be treated justly. We'll never be treated right. It's time for us to go. And if it weren't for God looking out for us, we'd be leaving empty-handed. And so then the sisters in unison, do whatever God has said to you. Now this is important because the sisters now are doing something. They are acknowledging God's hand being upon Jacob and in a sense against Laban their father. And they are acknowledging God's words to Jacob, and they are willing to take the risk with Jacob. Understand, traveling back with 12 children, two handmaidens, servants, livestock, traveling back 400 miles is going to be a risky thing. Add on top of that, Laban, who when he finds out is not going to be happy, and this is a risky thing. And in a real sense, what we're seeing with Leah and with Rachel is in a sense this spark of confidence in God. Notice I said spark and not flaming torch. Verse 17. Then Jacob arose and put his children and his wives upon camels, and he drove away all his livestock and all his property which he had gathered, his acquired livestock which he had gathered in Paddan Aram, to go to the land of Canaan to his father Isaac. When Laban had gone to shear his flock, then Rachel stole the household idols that were her father's. And Jacob deceived, literally, Jacob stole Laban's heart, the Aramean, by not telling him that he was fleeing. So he fled with all that he had. He arose and crossed the Euphrates River and set his face toward the hill country of Gilead. And so the scene unfolds, and you could imagine how many of you like to pack and move. Okay, Jacob has 20 years worth of stuff. And he is packing. He's got these 11 kids with 11 sons, one daughter, servants, wives, handmaidens, livestock. And the picture is that he's doing everything. He's doing his utmost as quickly as possible to get things together in order to get out. Well, so far, so good. But then the text tells us something that is slightly disturbing. Rachel knows that her father is out shearing sheep, which we'll talk about that in a second. And so she uses that as an opportunity to go and to steal her father's household idols. Now, you have to understand that just like today, even in our own area, the idea of shearing flocks, this is an annual event, and he and his men were probably spread out at some distance going where the flocks were, and Rachel takes this as an opportunity to go and to steal Laban's teraphim, his household idols. You have to understand that when the Old Testament talks about idols, It always talks about idols with double entendres, puns, and other ways to poke fun at the idols. And in fact, there is a little play on words with teraphim, meaning not only the idea of household idols, but it also sounds incredibly like a word that means impotent or foul things. The Old Testament scholars are not exactly sure what the teraphim were. In all likelihood, they could have been little figurines of ancestral gods. But then the big question is why in the world does Rachel think to herself, okay, we're moving, we're getting out of here, we're leaving my father's house. I know what I'll do. I'll go and steal the household idols. Maybe she did it out of spite, knowing how attached her father was to these household idols. Maybe she did it because she still had polytheistic tendencies and wanted a little extra protection. That's what household idols were for anyway. They provided protection. They actually secured blessing. And so maybe she had the idea, although I don't think that is actually true. She may have taken them for compensation because they would have had value for the bridal money that Laban had actually already used up. Whatever the case, Hamilton puts it like this: what we have here is a case of God napping. Rachel steals the household idols. Verse 20, there's a play on words. Most of our English Bibles don't capture the play on words. New American Standard: Jacob deceived Laban the Aramean. Look at the marginal reading. Jacob stole the heart of Laban the Aramean. Rachel steals the idols. Jacob steals his heart. Now, the play on words is certainly the idea of maybe tricking or deceiving Laban. And that sometimes has the idea of stealing somebody's heart. But Bruce Waltke points out that this phrase, stole the heart, involves the idea of taking away a person's ability to discern and act appropriately. To take away the heart, to steal the heart. No, don't think of it like, I met this beautiful girl at the Chevron station in 1985 and she stole my heart, all right? We talk like that, and it's kind of romanticized idea, but stealing the heart has the idea of actually taking away a person's ability to discern, person's ability to actually act and respond appropriately. And so what happens in verses 19 and 20, think of it this way, this is the grand finale. 20 years of struggle end up coming down to stealing the household idols and stealing Laban's heart. Rachel had taken away from Laban his ability to practice his divination with his idols, and Jacob would take away his ability to put his wits to work for his own advantage. Jacob and Rachel were two of a kind. And they flee. They cross over the Euphrates. So the land from which they fled, the land to which he fled for his own safety, is now the land that he's trying to return to for his own safety. And don't you know, he's trying to hurry. He's trying to hurry. Verse 22. When it was told Laban on the third day, notice that detail, on the third day, that Jacob had fled, then he took his kinsmen with him and pursued him a distance of 7 days' journey, and he overtook him in the country of Gilead. God came to Laban the Aramean in a dream of the night and said, "Be careful that you do not speak to Jacob either good or bad." Laban caught up with Jacob. Now, Jacob had pitched his tent in the hill country, and Laban with his kinsmen camped in the hill country of Gilead. Then Laban said to Jacob, "What have you done by deceiving me and carrying away my daughters like captives of the sword? Why did you flee secretly and deceive me and did not tell me so that I might have sent you away with joy and with songs, with timbrel and with lyre, and did not allow me to kiss my sons and my daughters? Now you have done foolishly. It is in my power to do you," by the way, the "you" is plural, "you all harm, but the God of your father spoke to me last night saying, be careful not to speak either good or bad to Jacob. Now you have indeed gone away because you longed greatly for your father's house, but why did you steal my gods?" The text tells us that it took Laban 3 days to find out. Do you know what's ironic about that? Is that it was Laban himself who had put those flocks at 3 days' distance in order to keep Jacob from having his flocks mix with his. And so he actually is, when he says he gathers his kinsmen, the idea is that he's taking his clan and he's preparing for battle. This is not preparing for some family reunion. Hey, we're all going to go see Rachel and Leah and that rotten guy Jacob that they married. But this is the idea that he's prepared to go and to take action, have a show of force, and take them back to Paddan Aram, if necessary, by force. And so that's his intention. He's going to go out. And remember, there's something about Laban that is really creepy. And that is, Laban looks at these daughters and these grandchildren as his property. Okay. And so they start the pursuit. And as they start the pursuit, guess what happens? God intervenes. By the way, just as God had done for Abraham and Abimelech, and just as he had done for Isaac, so now he does for Jacob. He intervenes with somebody that is intent on doing him harm, and basically God's message to Laban is this: you better watch out. You make sure that you don't say anything good or bad to Jacob. Does that language sound familiar? It's actually the very words that Laban had spoken many decades earlier when Abraham's servant had come and told them the story of God's providence and how Rebekah was the one. And of course, Laban wanted to retain her and keep Rebekah at that time. And then God appeared in a dream. And so Laban's response had to be, "This is of the Lord. We can say neither good nor bad." In other words, there's nothing we can say about it. I was going to come and try to bring you all back, but the God of your fathers actually appeared to me in a dream, and now he has told me that I cannot say anything either way about what you are doing. One of the terrifying things about Laban is the fact that that stolen heart is now going to be revealed. Did you hear the things that he said? Laban is a self-deceived, deluded person. They make camp, they're within striking distance, and the very first thing that Laban communicates to Jacob is this: "Why have you taken my daughters away like captives of the sword?" Well, actually, they decided to go quite willingly. Jacob didn't hold a sword to their necks and force them to go with him. In fact, if anybody had treated the daughters like captives, it wasn't Jacob, it was Laban. And then he says, Why didn't you tell me you were leaving? I would have thrown you a really big party. I have no doubt that Rachel and Leah and Zilpah and Bildah and Jacob and all of the grandkids looked around at each other and said, really? Do you think he would have thrown us a party? No. The last party he threw was 20 years earlier, and it only turned out good for him. He wasn't about to throw them a party. And then he says, you didn't allow me to kiss my sons and my daughters. Laban believes that those children and those daughters are his. He missed the whole leave and cleave thing. And then he says this to Jacob in front of his wives and in front of his children. He says, you've acted foolishly. He's trying to embarrass Jacob in front of his wives. And the reality is that it is Laban who has played the fool. And then he says these words, and these words probably reflect the attitude of his heart more than anything else. I could hurt all of you. You see all these men behind me? You see the fact that they're all armed? You see the fact that they know how to take care of business? The fact is I could hurt all of you, and there's only one thing standing in my way, and that is your God spoke to me. This is his heart. He doesn't care about the well-being of his daughters. He doesn't care about the well-being of his grandchildren. But he thinks that he has power to actually do whatever he pleases. But now he simply knows better because the awesome one of Isaac, the fear of Isaac, has intervened on behalf of his servant Jacob, and Laban knows it. And so, once he gets down to the end and gives this blustery boast of, I could hurt all of you right now, but God just simply told me that I couldn't. Then he turns around and he says, I know that you've been longing for your father's house, you little mama's boy. I knew there was something wrong with you from the day that you got here. I noticed you like to cook. You long for your father's house, but then here's the real issue for Laban. Why did you steal my gods? That's funny. You think it might just slightly occur to Laban that if your God can be stolen, maybe he's not real. You've stolen my gods. And now I'm going to say that for Laban, this is probably his deepest grievance. And as no matter what you think about Rachel taking the gods, it ironically will be the fact that Rachel took them and hid them that will end up serving as Jacob's vindication and send Laban on his way. God's ways are strange. Verse 31. You have to remember, Jacob has been serving Laban for 20 years. You ever work for a bad boss for 20 years? You ever work for somebody that was just always changing the terms on you and always demanding more and giving less? You ever worked for Pharaoh? If you're old enough, you'll remember Johnny Paycheck. And he came out with the national anthem of the working man. Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. And of course, the rest of it, my woman done left and took all the reason I was a working for, but that's beside the point. Now, 20 years of working for Pharaoh, and Jacob has pent up anger. And he is about to let Laban have it. Verse 31, Jacob replied to Laban, because I was afraid, for I thought that you would take your daughters from me by force. The one with whom you find your gods shall not live in the presence of our kinsmen. Point out what is yours among my belongings and take it for yourself. For Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them. So Jacob says, you know, as far as me going back to my father's house, here's what you need to understand, Uncle Laban, is the fact that it has become self-evident that you are going to do me harm and that you are going to use force against me. And my only chance for survival is to get back to my father's house. And by the way, as far as your stupid, silly little gods, and then notice Jacob's rash vow, death penalty for the one that you find with your gods. Oh, Jacob needs God on his side. This is a rash vow. Verse 33. So Laban went into Jacob's tent and into Leah's tent and into the tent of the two maids, but he did not find them. Then he went out of Leah's tent and entered Rachel's tent. So you got to get the picture. So Laban is actually now, he's furious, and now Jacob has said, you know what, if you find those gods here, whoever has them, death penalty to them. And so then Laban starts just rummaging through, and he begins by rummaging through the tents of his daughters. He's ransacking the tents. He's looking for these gods. And then there's this dramatic sense of buildup. And then he enters Rachel's tent. Dramatic music. Now, verse 34, Rachel had taken the household idols and put them into a camel's saddle, and she sat on them. And Laban felt through all the tent, but he did not find them. She said to her father, let not my lord be angry that I cannot rise before you, for the manner of woman is upon me. So he searched, but did not find the household idols. Now, I've wondered how far to explain if you were a Hebrew and you heard this, you would start laughing, all right? Because it's supposed to be funny. In Hebrew Bible, they're always poking fun at the gods. Satire, sarcasm, mockery. And so here's the picture. Laban searching frantically for his missing deities, rummaging through stuff in the tents, and he goes into Rachel's tent, and he's rummaging around, and then here she is sitting down, and Laban says, hey, get up so I can look around. And she says, with this really, this insincere politeness and deference, excuse me, my lord, but I cannot get up, for the manner of woman is upon me. Here's the picture. Lord, help me. Laban's gods are stuffed in a camel saddle, and Rachel has them pinned down. Okay? Now, you have to admit, the strength of Laban's gods comes into question if they can be pinned down by one woman. But then, to add insult to injury, she is defiling these gods through the manner of woman which is upon her. Bruce Waltke perhaps says it in the most sophisticated way. Rachel has reduced Laban's household gods to sanitary napkins. Now, guess what Laban is not about ready to do? That's fine. We'll skip the saddle. Okay? Now, Laban's search comes up empty. Verse 36. Then Jacob became angry. So now he's going to start to vent with, and he contended with Laban. And Jacob said to Laban, "What is my transgression? What is my sin that you've hotly pursued me? Though you have felt through all my goods, what have you found of all your household goods? Set it here before me, my kinsmen and your kinsmen, that they may decide between us two. These 20 years I have been with you. Your ewes and your female goats have not miscarried, nor have I eaten the rams of your flock. That which was torn of beasts I did not bring to you. I bore the loss of it myself. You required of my hand, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. Thus I was. By the day the heat consumed me, and the frost by night, and my sleep fled from my eyes. These 20 years I have been in your house. I have served you 14 years for your two daughters, 6 years for your flock, and you've changed my wages 10 times. If the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had not been for me, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. God has seen my affliction and the toil of my hands, and so he has rendered judgment last night." Wow! Now, I don't know about this, like, mic-dropping thing, but I've seen these commercials, you know? And I think that if there was a mic-drop moment, that this was it. This is like, boom! And so, Fokelman says this. He says, "The tables are now turned. Laban, the prosecutor, becomes Laban, the accused. And Jacob leaves the defensive to take the offensive, a final, frontal, massive attack." And so Jacob has become angry. After the search comes up empty, it says he contended with Laban. Contend, Hebrew word, is reeve, which has the idea of lawsuit. And so 20 years of pent-up frustration, anger bursts forth, and he says, "So tell me now, Uncle Laban, dear old father-in-law, what is my transgression?" In essence, you are the real transgressor. Your accusation of stolen gods and stolen goods is a joke. In fact, let your people and my people adjudicate. This then leads him into a 20-year complaint. "For 20 years I've served you." This is like a bad marriage counseling session. They go, he starts back 20 years ago. "I served you. I cared for your flocks. I never, ever took advantage of you. I took all of the losses," which, by the way, shepherds were not required to do, the things that he just says. "I bore the heat of the day, the frost of the night. I went without sleep," doing what? "Caring for your property, caring for your flocks. And for 20 years I've been in your house. 14 of those years I worked for your two daughters." Now, notice he very graciously leaves out the grand switch. "6 years I labored for your flocks, and you're the one that's changed my wages these 10 times. In other words, who is the real thief here?" Jacob then makes another open profession. This is wonderful. "If it were not for the God of my father, the God of Abraham," and then how do you like this for a divine title? "The fear of Isaac." The fear of Isaac. The idea, the awesome one of Isaac. The God who actually is so awesome, so terrifying, he intervenes on behalf of our people. And if it weren't for him, you would have sent me away empty-handed. And then he says this language, it gets repeated. So God has seen my affliction, Exodus language, the toil of my hands, and it's God who's rendered judgment. It's God who's made the decision. The reason you didn't find anything is because you, sir, are the thief. You, sir, are the liar. You, sir, are the cheat. And God has vindicated me. Verse 43, then Laban replied to Jacob. This is amazing. The daughters are my daughters, and the children are my children, and the flocks are my flocks, and all that you see is mine. He's deluded. He's deluded. But what can I do this day to these my daughters or to their children whom they have born? Everything you see, Jacob, is mine. But what can I do about it? The deceiver of the deceiver has been beaten. And so his conclusion is this. So let's make a covenant. Okay, let's make a covenant. Now, let's make a covenant. It looks like this. We're going to take stone pillars and we're going to take heaps of stone. And we're going to eat a meal. Ancient world, when you cut a covenant, you ate a meal. Now, what happens is, they both name the heaps different things. Jacob is using the language of Canaan. The heaps of stones will serve as a witness against each other. By the way, what was the symbolism of the heap of stones? It was either death or ruin. In other words, the covenant that they were making was, if you cross me or I cross you, may what this heap symbolizes, death and ruination, may it come upon you. They then give it different names, but meaning the same thing. Watchtower, the idea, may the Lord watch between you and me. And then ironically, Laban says, and here's what you're promising to him, what God's watching out, that you won't harm my daughters. Who's the one who had really harmed them? You won't harm my daughters, and I won't harm you. And then, you have to notice this, verse 53 says, the God of Abraham and the God of Nahor. I'm going to suggest that the second word for God should be lowercase g. I don't think that Laban is actually swearing by the same God, but two different gods. Jacob's God and the God of his fathers back in Ur of the Chaldees. May they judge between us. And then Jacob swears, offers sacrifice, and eats a meal. Now, this covenant is incredibly significant. And I know I'm running out of time, but let me just point out something a little humorous. Evangelicals have taken this passage and turned it into jewelry. You ever see the little pendant called the Mizpah pendant? It's a pendant, and it's got a zigzag between it that's supposed to fit together. And on the one side, does anybody know what I'm talking about? Okay, yeah, some of you, okay. And on the one side, it says, the Lord watch between me and thee. And on the other side, it says, when we are absent from one another. And the idea of this Mizpah pendant signifies a special bond with somebody, as if, may God kind of watch out for us while we're apart, because friends are friends forever, and that's what friends are for. Okay, so this is worse than the prayer of Jabez, actually, I think, because the covenant that takes place here is not a covenant signifying a deep emotional bond between Laban and Jacob. You understand that, right? It's not as if they're saying, we'll meet again. It's actually, I hope we never meet again. And in fact, while we're not meeting again, may God keep an eye on both of us. And may God bring death and ruination to whatever one breaks this covenant. My heart's wed to yours. It's a non-aggression pact is what it is. May God keep an eye on both of us and may he bring swift justice against the one who violates the pact. Verse 55 ends the passage. Early in the morning, Laban arose, kissed his sons and daughters, blessed them, and Laban departed and returned to his place. Laban can do absolutely nothing. And guess who it is who returns empty-handed? It's not Jacob. It's Laban. This is the vindication of God for his servant. Now, we got to do this quickly, but there are two big picture themes that you can't miss here. First of all, what is happening? Well, God is arranging the furniture, so to speak, by fulfilling his promise to Jacob and to Isaac and to Abraham. He's getting the seed of Abraham back into the promised land. Okay? And you look at this, and you look at these 55 verses, and you look at the passages that have gone before, and you say, you mean to tell me that God is actually doing all of this just to get his people back into the promised land? Couldn't God have done this in just a simpler way? That's what we sometimes think, right? So the providence of God, why does it have to be so complicated? Well, here's the reason, is because there is a beauty in God's purposes, and the fact is that God is always doing something more than just the big thing. He's doing 10,000, 20,000, 30,000, innumerable smaller things in accomplishing that big thing. And so God will take the circuitous route. God will take the route that takes 400 years as opposed to 4 minutes. And so William Cooper says his purposes will ripen fast, unfolding every hour. The bud may have a bitter taste, but sweet will be the flower. The second big picture thing is this. The parallels to Israel and Egypt and then the subsequent Exodus are striking. And it would be this passage, among others, that would serve to encourage the Israelites in their own pilgrimage. When facing overwhelming odds, they would recall how their forefather Jacob had encountered the very same thing. And just as it encouraged the Israelites of old, it's designed to encourage us as well. It's designed to remind us that we're on a pilgrimage, and as we're on that pilgrimage, God actually sees the details. He knows the details. He's arranged the details, and he hears us in the midst of our affliction, and he is at work, and we are on our way. On a personal level, God's continuing to transform Jacob. In fact, Jacob is becoming more and more a man of faith. Here's the good news. He doesn't show much promise at the start. But which of us did? He's been chasing now for 20 years. And he's learned some lessons, and he's learned some hard lessons, and he's learned them the hard way. And he is learning that his security rests in his Lord and not in his own cleverness. And the very God who took care of his father Abraham and his father Isaac is the God who is taking care of him. One last thing. And then there's Laban. I'd be negligent if I didn't say something about Laban. Laban is a man who is deluded. Laban is a man who has created his own story made up of his own facts in order to cover his own sins. And before you think of the six people in your life that fit that description, just realize that there's probably a little bit of Laban in our own hearts. Proverbs 16:2, all the ways of a man are what? Clean in his own sight, but it's the Lord who weighs the motives. It's Laban who actually stands out in this story from the very beginning as one who suffers from an irrationality. Why? Because he sees himself as the righteous one, and in reality, he's the greedy one. And in reality, he's the one that uses other people. And in reality, he's the one that's always wronging other people. He's the one that's always trying to take advantage of other people, trying to possess other people, including even his own daughters and grandchildren. And even in the face of God intervening, all he can do is slink away, not in humility, but in begrudging defeat. Because throughout the process, he never discovered his own self-deceit. What a lesson! You know what that lesson actually, it's a clarion call to us. Watch your own heart. Can I just tell you that if you live the kind of life where everybody else is always wrong, and everybody else is always the jerk, it's a pretty good indication that you're making up your own story, made up of your own facts to justify your own sin. If you wake up and live the course of your day and you just think you've met one jerk after another, after another, after another, guess who actually was meeting the jerk? Self-deceit is one of the hardest things for us to acknowledge and for us to accept about ourselves, and yet it is self-deceit that is the cancer of the human heart. Jacob is humbled. Jacob is vindicated. Jacob is now trusting in the Lord, not on his own devices. And there stands Laban, self-deceived, restrained, but still self-deceived. The heart is wicked, desperately wicked. It is deceitful above a few things in life. It is deceitful what? Above all else. Who can know it? Do you understand that Laban is a reflection for us to stop in our tracks and to realize I'm probably the problem. G.K. Chesterton, British Roman Catholic of 100 years ago or so, famous literary figure, London Times, going to have an essay contest. The topic of the essay that everybody was going to submit, and of course Chesterton was considered to be the winner. I mean, he barely had to do anything, right? He's brilliant. And so the topic was, what is wrong with the world today? And Chesterton sent in his essay, and it simply said, I am sincerely G.K. Chesterton. We don't like to think that we're actually the problem. But before we ever take one step of accusation against those dirty, rotten, no good, low down scoundrels that have wronged us, we need to stop and we need to say, Lord, how am I deceiving myself? Ariel and I argue once in a while. She actually argues with me, and I just sit there seraphically and intercede for her. No. That's self-deceit. You know, one of the hardest things when you're in conflict with somebody is just to stop and to say, I'm really making a mess of things right now because I'm self-deceived. May God help us to search our own hearts before Him and to be honest before Him. The God with whom we have to do knows better. And we're not fooling anybody except ourselves. God, help us to have a judgment day honesty in dealing with one another. Let's pray. Father, thank you for this passage that is just filled with so many troubling things. And we thank you that your word is a mirror in which we can see our flaws, our sins. We pray that you'd help us today. Help us, Lord, to be honest with you, honest with ourselves, honest with those around us. And in that honesty, may we run to the cross of Jesus. There is a fountain filled with blood drawn from Emmanuel's veins, and sinners plunged beneath that flood lose all their guilty stains. Amen.
We hope that you were edified by this message. For additional sermons as well as information on giving to the ministry of Grace Community Church, please visit us online at gracenevada.com. That's gracenevada.com.